C3 Radio aus dem Zentrum für internationale Entwicklung. Socially just climate policies at a global scale, which way forward? Unter diesem Titel hat am 27. März 2023 eine von der ÖFSE organisierte Online-Diskussion stattgefunden. In der heutigen Ausgabe von C3 Radio berichten wir darüber. Es begrüßt Sie Jürgen Planck. Die Klimakrise ist eine Herausforderung für die ganze Welt. Die Fähigkeit, sich anzupassen und die Folgen abzumildern, ist jedoch zwischen dem globalen Norden und dem globalen Süden ungleich verteilt. Der von der Klimakrise stärker betroffene globale Süden hat in internationalen Diskussionen aktuell keine starke Stimme. Während es weltweit Konsens über die Notwendigkeit einer sozial gerechten Klimapolitik gibt, ist noch unklar, wie diese erreicht werden kann. Diese Debatte wirft auch Fragen wie die folgenden auf. Werden sich Entwicklungs- und Schwellenländer zwischen industrieller Entwicklung und Klimazielen entscheiden müssen? Werden die armen Länder die Rechnung für die Reduzierung der globalen Treibhausgase bezahlen müssen? Ist es gerecht, dass viele arme Länder, die wenig zum menschengemachten Klimawandel beigetragen haben, schwere Verluste und Schäden erleiden? Eine solidarische, multilaterale Zusammenarbeit scheint notwendig und unumgänglich zu sein. Die Online-Diskussion am 27. März 2023 wurde von ÖFSE-Forscherin Karin Kübelböck moderiert.
Just a few words about the context of our discussion. The assessment report of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change, was released last week. I think our discussion cannot be more timely because the report says that we are in a crisis of our own making and that especially developing countries and small countries in the global south are suffering climate change disproportionately. The IPCC report also says that there is still time to act, but we have to act very urgently, and governments are not acting at the speed that is necessary to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So there is a very high urgency, and this requires global leadership, and everybody will look, especially also at the G20 summit, as 3/4 of global greenhouse gas emissions are coming from rich countries. But what is also new in this report, that for the first time there has been a long debate on the different roles and responsibilities of different countries for those greenhouse gas emissions. And the last COP conference on climate change saw also a historic win for vulnerable countries, as finally the world's government agreed to set up a loss and damage fund to help countries to recover from climate devastation. And it is interesting because there was also debate about compensation for the climate crisis, but the fund and the debate is not called compensation because this would be an even bigger responsibility that is recognized, but it's called loss and damage fund, but it's already recognized as a progress to recognize the role of rich countries in the global climate crisis and in the fact that vulnerable countries in the global south are bearing most of the costs. So this is the debate that we are going to have today. On one hand, what does the IPCC report mean for our concrete topic? And also, how can we understand global climate justice? And is what the IPCC report says, and especially also what the Paris negotiations say, is this already enough for dealing with global climate justice? Or what else is needed in order to have globally just climate policies and to fight against the climate crisis?
Dann stellt die Moderatorin die erste Diskutantin vor.
Rana Haynes, she's Director of Climate Analytics Caribbean and Team Lead of the Alliance of Small State Islands. She provides strategic, technical and diplomatic advice to island states in the climate negotiations, so she's a very experienced negotiator as well. And she's also training officials to participate in the UN climate process.
From a personal perspective, this is one of the most alarming IPCC reports that I have ever read. So as you said, Karen, we do have time, but that time is vanishingly small. So I want to highlight maybe three main takeaways that I had from the report.
Als erstes erwähnt Rana Haynes ein SDM, ein Species Distribution Model, das zeigt, in welchem Ausmaß diese und folgende Generationen von der Klimakrise betroffen sein werden.
That was really striking for me because it clearly illustrates that some of the people who are going to face very, very, very high temperatures of warming on the current trajectory have already been born. The second focuses on the choices and the fact that the choices and the actions that we implement in this decade will have impact even maybe for thousands of years. And that to me was also quite a striking message. Final one has to do with this question of time and, you know, the options that we have and the fact that the longer we wait, the less options will be available to us.
Vor kurzem, sagt Haynes, sei sie auf den Marshall Islands gewesen.
And, you know, they are developing their national adaptation plan and discussing options that they have, understanding that their range of options may be limited, but they are keenly interested in giving themselves options. And for a country like that, it's very clear that the longer we delay, that range of options that they are hoping to have for their people, for their survival, for their entire civilization is going to drastically decrease.
What kind of impact does this report have on your work, and does it support what you're doing, and how would you assess the discussions on the global climate justice and on your perspectives that you bring into the global climate negotiation?
So the report highlights that there is a major disconnect between what we're talking about at the global policy level and what is actually required of us according to the science. Global climate justice, for me, we don't have necessarily an agreed working definition, but there can be no climate justice if we are not protecting the needs of the most vulnerable. If the most vulnerable are not being protected, if they are being exposed, then there is no justice in the decisions that we make, in the policy frameworks that we put in place, in the actions that we take in order to address this crisis. My work at the regional level involves bringing a very, very diverse range of stakeholders to the table to discuss a Caribbean approach to climate justice and to nail down what it would mean for the Caribbean as a region in, you know, different spheres of work. And one of the things I want to highlight from that discussion has been the inclusivity of it. And so it is a climate change discussion, but everyone is at the table. So those who are working primarily in the human rights field, those who are working on women's issues, those who are working with indigenous groups, those who are working on more governance-related issues, the right to information, the right to public participation. These are in addition to individuals who are, you know, working on adaptation issues and working more in the climate change space. And the discussion, and also including as well, you know, participants from the labor movement as well, from academia. So the discussion from the very beginning has been a very inclusive one, where we have been able to look at the issue in an intersectional way of picking up on the different needs and priorities of different groups, but trying to understand where and how we can work together to forge really a common agenda that would then inform the approach that governments take when they go out into the global discussion. And I think that this inclusivity is something that we do not do very well at the international level. You know, we still have to have a discussion around who gets to be at the table, who doesn't get to be at the table, even in the context of the upcoming discussions on the transitional committee for the loss, the establishment of the loss and damage funding arrangements and the loss and damage fund.
Sagt Rowena Haynes von Climate Analytics Caribbean.
I also would like to present Sarah Mohameda Valencia. She is a PhD candidate at the Mercator Research Institute on Global Commons on Climate and Climate Change. And her research focus is on understanding public perceptions of climate policy in low and middle income countries. You're dealing with understanding public perceptions in climate policy in low and middle income countries. And she's dealing with different effects of carbon pricing on different income groups or between countries. So also a very timely topic, because carbon pricing is always seen as one of the key instruments for fighting against the climate crisis. What are your takeaways from the IPCC report related to your topic? You're working on a very important topic, which is carbon pricing. Lots of people, they know the word carbon pricing, but maybe they don't know how it really works and how technically it will work and who will benefit from carbon pricing, who will pay it. So what are your main takeaways from this report, also for your work that you're doing? One is public perceptions and the other is carbon pricing. And then to explain us a little bit more, what are the current discussions about carbon pricing and what you think would be effects and what would make sense?
I'm very much focusing my research first and foremost on public perceptions and public opinions of pricing policies or climate policies. And in this instance, looking much closer at pricing policies. And so from the most recent IPCC report, when I'm looking at, since the policy I'm focused on is carbon pricing, some people are very strict with their carbon pricing definition. They look at a carbon price as something that explicitly puts a price on carbon emissions. But I also include other policies such as fossil fuel subsidies as an implicit carbon pricing policy. A fossil fuel subsidy is, in this case, a negative carbon price. So if there is a market value for, let's say, gasoline, so that's the general market value that has been put in place, a carbon tax, for example, on CO2 emissions would also consider what would be the impact of a specific gasoline, for example, on emitting CO2 and pricing these CO2 emissions to also be reflected in the price. So not just what are the cost benefits of it on a pure market base, but also internalizing these negative externalities. So this negative effect on environment and social well-being, for example. What I like about this recent IPCC report with regards to carbon pricing is that it looks at both a positive carbon price and a fossil fuel subsidy as something that needs to be tackled simultaneously. So no longer just talking about a carbon tax, but also considering fossil fuel subsidy reform. And I think this is a positive development because when I'm looking at my current research, where I'm looking at public opinion surveys of carbon pricing policies, the majority of these surveys are conducted in the global north, and they primarily look at how public opinions are around explicitly carbon taxes. And very, very few have actually looked at how public perceives fossil fuel subsidy reforms. So at this point, we know a lot about public opinions from some countries and very little from other countries. And as Karin was saying, as Wena was also indicating, these distributional aspects are interesting to know, like who's going to be impacted, but the procedure, like who has a voice, whose opinion do we value, what do we know about different ways that these policies are perceived, is limited to high-income countries, specifically on carbon tax.
Sagt Farah Mohammadzadeh Valencia, damit zur dritten Diskutantin, Gertraud Wolanski.
She is a senior advisor on climate issues at the Austrian Federal Ministry for Climate Action, and she has been working on different aspects of climate change for almost 30 years. She's a lot of expertise and experience in the topic of climate change and also in negotiations. She's the coordinator of the EU Group of Finance Experts, and she's co-chair of the Standing Committee on Finance under the UNFCCC.
On the IPCC report, I wish I could say that it will change the negotiations or the work that we are doing on Austrian policies. I'm afraid it doesn't. This is the sixth assessment report, and we have seen the reception of the reports before. There will be scientific discussions also in the negotiations, no doubt, and that is a good thing. But I have yet to see that it really would influence the outcomes of negotiations. I'm sorry to be so cynical about it. And if negotiators are doing what their governments tell them to do, let's be clear about that. If politicians all over the world had listened to what these reports said, we would be in a very different world from what we are.
Von Mal zu Mal würden die IPCC-Reports besorgniserregender, sagt Gertraud Wolanski. Trotz viel Zustimmung würde ihr nach der Präsentation jedes Berichtes konsequentes Handeln fehlen.
Sorry for not being able to say something different. And I'm being very honest here.
I mean, you have been in many negotiations. My question would be, and also because Rwanda talked about the pink elephant that is not talked about, what would it need to kind of be more honest? Or is within, between the negotiators, is there an awareness of the urgency? And then they are not able to kind of bring in what they want to bring in? Or is it, or are national interests and vested interests so dominant that it's not even a topic within the negotiations, that it's much more urgent and much more has to be done than what is coming out?
I think the word urgency is the most used, one of the most used in the negotiations. But everybody has their own interpretations of what is urgent now. When some say we need to take urgent mitigation action, the response is usually happy to do so. And where is the finance?
In Bezug auf Finanzierungsfragen bringt Wolanski selbst einen interessanten Vorschlag.
I always love to listen to a colleague from the Alliance of Small Island States when she says, if all subsidies to fossil fuels could be converted into climate finance, the problem would be a lot easier. And if we could make the fossil fuel industry pay for the effects, it would make things a lot easier.
Sagt Gertrud Wolanski. Die Online-Diskussion am 27. März 2023 hat auch Chat-Fragen aus dem Publikum berücksichtigt, etwa jene von Johanna.
What specific role do you see for civil society players to trigger change? What suggestions would you give civil society organizations that work in development cooperation and want to target climate justice throughout their work to support their partners in the global south? Maybe, Rana, you work with a coalition of civil society organizations on climate crisis. What is the specific role of civil society and how could this make sense in advancing the discussion and the action?
There's no means of actually being able to implement climate change solutions, especially not in the region where I'm from, without the partnership, government partnership with civil society. Government can only do so much. Fiscal space is limited. Sovereign debt is high. Priorities are many. Civil society is key for being able to reach people that governments cannot reach for whatever reason, and also for being able to actually help to generate solutions that work and that are sustainable. Civil society in my region is chronically underfunded. For the most part, the Caribbean is considered middle-income or high-income countries, and there is no financing for the work that the civil society in this region does. It's very, very limited. Most civil society organizations are being headed by women. They're also being driven by, you know, people who are receiving very little to no compensation for their work. People who have to also maintain full-time jobs in order to be able to support their families while they do their work. Civil society work in the environmental or climate space in the Caribbean is considered to be work for martyrs and those seeking martyrdom, especially in instances where it might bring you into direct conflict with the political priorities of the day. And so I would say one of the main ways to be able to support that work and to support partners is by actually sharing resources with them. There's no major philanthropy in the Caribbean that's operating here to be able to provide philanthropic sources of funding for the work that civil society does. So especially when it comes to issues around climate justice in particular, I think even giving a listening ear to understand the perspective is valuable. Civil society organizations of the North do have a different type of relationship with their governments. There tends to be, from my perspective, more opportunities to engage and opportunities to influence policy. And to the extent that those opportunities can be used to also reflect back views from the Global South, I think that's also highly useful.
In Bezug auf die Einbindung der Zivilgesellschaft berichtet Karin Kübelböck über die erfolgreiche Arbeit des österreichischen Klimarates.
I was one of the facilitators of the Austrian Climate Assembly. There were 100 randomly chosen people. They had time for over 6 weekends to discuss climate policies. And it was amazing to look what information can do if people get really good information. And they were at the end of those 6 weekends, they really compiled about 90 concrete demands that were going much further than what the government would have thought that citizens were able to do. And the same happened in Spain, the same happened in many other countries. So I think this, how do you inform a public in order that certain measures are accepted, is a very important topic to also talk about. What would you see as important issues to address, as important steps to take in terms of public opinion, in terms of regulations, in terms of voices that have to be brought in? What I've taken away from our discussion so far, for me, the key word of the problem analysis is the disconnect between what is discussed and what is actually important, the disconnect about what is happening behind the scenes and in the front room. What are the next important steps to be taken in the different fields, maybe also for civil society, for government, for information?
This year, the international community, we have charged ourselves with the awesome responsibility to assess our implementation of the Paris Agreement and all of the Paris Agreement goals, and to essentially make recommendations for how we close the gaps in that implementation, including in relation to international cooperation. We've set ourselves the task of visioning a new model of international cooperation on climate change, but the process isn't actually set up for us to have that discussion. And so it needs to come from somewhere. And I would very much like to see civil society around the world mobilizing around that idea, understanding that we cannot solve every problem at the same time. You know, questions around sustainable consumption and production, the degrowth debate, all of that is highly relevant, but none of that can happen like that.
Farah, do you want to continue?
I think with regards to the research questions that my team and I, we're addressing this, since we're very often looking at carbon pricing and fossil fuel subsidy reform, the question remains how to implement such market-based instruments, like how do you implement these types of policies while also considering equity and distributional impacts? So making the effort of understanding each country specifically, each income group specifically, is already a first very important start to kind of understand what the consequences would be of such ambitious climate policies that have an impact on more vulnerable households, and also to consider the public opinion of people on these policies. I would love to understand with more nuance how the public of other countries perceive certain policies, so that this understanding that if we don't know what people in other countries believe, so we usually believe that they don't know very much. And I think that's a myth that can be busted by focusing more on public participation, if not public participation, at least public understanding and public opinion, because that could also, in other ways, help policymakers make better communication campaigns. So treating the public as a knowing entity and that has an understanding is something that I would personally like to see more of, especially given the fact that these protests by the public have really impeded climate policies to be implemented. They're not a stakeholder group to be ignored or labeled as irrational unknowing. I think there's a lot of understanding and a lot of reasons why people behave in the ways that they do. And if we have a better understanding, we could possibly create better policies that are implemented.
In ihrem Abschlussstatement geht Gertrud Wolanski auf bevorstehende Aufgaben der UNFCCC, der United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, ein. Und sie verweist auf die 28. UN-Klimakonferenz, die COP28, Conference of Parties, die ab Ende November 2023 in Dubai stattfinden wird.
We have a really challenging year in the UNFCCC this year. There are so many parallel processes running. We have the global stocktake, we have the discussions on the just transition, discussions on implementing Article 21C on aligning finance flows. We have the transitional committee on the funding arrangements for loss and damage. My hope is that these things will not carry on in isolation, but that we will see the synergies and the linkages and be able to bring things together at the COP to make a full picture and not remain multiplying agenda items that don't connect. Because I think only if we manage to make these synergies in the negotiations that we get the picture of what we should bring to the real world outside, and to be also to be taken more seriously in our messages.
Zusammenfassend sagt Moderatorin Karin Kübelböck.
Thank you very much. Those are very important final points that you gave to us, and I think it gave the discussion gave us a lot of food for thought on actually how to connect the dots, how to bring different discussions together, how to be more transparent and how to close gaps actually, and how to end the disconnect between different levels of discussion, between different actors. And I think there's a lot of different strategies and things to be done by different actors.
Das war C3 Radio. Heute zur Online-Veranstaltung zum Thema Socially Just Climate Policies at a Global Scale. Which Way Forward vom 27. März 2023. Den IPCC-Report kann man auf dieser Webseite herunterladen, www.ipcc.ch. Den Report Österreichische Entwicklungspolitik und weitere Papers und Kommentare der OFSE findet man auf www.ofse.at. Über die Arbeit von Climate Analytics Caribbean informiert man sich auf climateanalytics.org. Noch bis 30. April sind Einreichungen zum heurigen C3 Award möglich. Informationen dazu und zu allen Angeboten im C3 findet man auf www.zentrum3.at. Ein Veranstaltungshinweis. Am 12. April 2023 findet im Festsaal 1 an der Wirtschaftsuniversität Wien eine Veranstaltung zum Thema Geflüchtete an österreichischen Hochschulen statt. Wir werden darüber in der Mai-Ausgabe unserer Sendung berichten. C3 Radio gibt es wieder in einem Monat und jederzeit als Podcast auf Spotify. Folgen Sie C3 Radio und der ÖFSE bitte auch auf Facebook. Auf Wiederhören sagt Jürgen Planck. C3 Radio aus dem Zentrum für internationale Entwicklung. Mit den Organisationen Baobab, Frauensolidarität, Mattersburger Kreis, ÖFSE und Paulo Freire Zentrum. Weitere Informationen und Podcast auf www.zentrum3.at.